Often things come unstuck, difficulties arise, tensions mount when expectations are not spoken of or revealed. If I'm expecting to have a chilled, relaxed day, and the boys and Roz are expecting, no, we have things to do and places to see, one of us is going to be disappointed. And we all know who. And if your expectations, say, about a new job are, you know, that it will be a specific, particular, certain way, and you get there and things are very different, you're going to be disappointed. Higher the expectations, the greater the disappointment when they're not met. That's why I work on very low expectations, particularly when it comes to football. But you can imagine that this is even more important when it comes to following Christ. Many have come unstuck, turned their backs on Jesus because in their mind, what they expected when they said yes to following Christ turns out it wasn't quite what they'd hoped. And it's often because they weren't taught rightly, or they were given false expectations, or they just not read their Bibles. But whatever it was, they turned their backs because it wasn't what they thought. And Jesus, in his early days of his ministry, begins to outline what it will mean to follow him. He's laying out the expectations. He's making it very clear, this is what it will mean to follow me. And it probably looks very different to what you expected. And from chapter 6, verse 20, through to really the end of chapter 6, Jesus is really outlining what it looked like to be his. And in verses 20 to 26, our passage this morning, we see, look, firstly, Jesus is talking to his disciples. Have a look, verse 20. Looking at his disciples. In other words, he's speaking to them. Verse 22, it spells it out even more so as he talks about persecution. He makes it clear they'll be rejected and hated because of him, because they're his, because they're following him. And so Jesus is clearly speaking to his disciples, those who will follow him. But there are others listening in. There's a great crowd, verse 17. Some of them are disciples, but there's a great number of people from all over Judea, from Jerusalem, from the coastal region around Tyre and Sidon. It's a bit like a Sunday morning here for us. You know, there are those of us who are believers, who love Jesus, who are following him, and there are those who are most welcome, who are not yet following Christ, but they're listening in. That's what's happening here. Jesus is teaching his disciples, but others are listening in as he does so. And in verses 20 to 23, he's saying, look, this is what it will be to follow me. And in verses 24 to 26, here's the warning for those who don't. Now, at this point, it's worth just pausing just for a moment and saying, particularly to those familiar with their Bibles, this is different to the Beatitudes in Matthew's Gospel. Firstly, it's a different location. So in Matthew, Jesus is on the mountain. Here in Luke, Jesus is down from the mountain, verse 17, and he's standing on a level place. He's on a plain. It's often referred to as the Sermon on the Plain. It's most likely, therefore, a different but similar sermon recorded for us. You notice, well, if you're familiar with the Beatitudes in Matthew, Matthew has 9 Beatitudes, Luke has 4. Luke's are all, if I can put it this way, negative virtues or less aspiring. They don't have things like peacemakers or meekness. Also, Luke adds the woe section, where Jesus spells out what it will be for those not following. So although there are similarities, there are differences. And you need to keep that in mind. Now, with that said, let's have a look then at what Jesus expects for those who follow him. Verses 20 to 23, blessed are those who are Christ's. And that word blessed appears 4 times. To be blessed is to experience God's favor, his happiness, his smile, his goodness, his kindness, to know that what we are doing is right. As we seek to walk with him, that we're walking in his purposes, we're blessed. And this, straight away, is where you begin to see why it's important to have right expectations. Especially for these first hearers who were largely Jewish, but also for us. See, remember, Jesus has just taught them that his ways, following him, involves change. See, flip back to the end of chapter 5. Remember, Jesus said it's new wineskins. And when we looked at it, we talked about how you can't tack the new, the gospel, onto the old, onto old Judaism. It's all change because of Jesus. Things are different. And in the Old Testament, God's blessing on his people was largely seen in material ways. Wealth, land, good crops, large families. And so when in Deuteronomy, Moses is teaching the people before they enter the land, he says, look, if you obey God's law, you will be blessed. And how will that blessing be seen? Well, the Lord will be with them. He'll remain present amongst them. But it will also be seen in good crops, plenty of food, large families. There would be protection and security from your enemies. You'd be well thought of by other nations. And of course, part of what's happening in the Old Testament is God is giving a shadow of his kingdom. He's given a picture of the promised land, heaven. It's a foretaste of what life in heaven will, with God for all eternity, will be like. It's unlimited blessing. It's like the drinks fountain at the Harvester. You know those unlimited drinks? My children think that is blessing upon blessing. You know? Heaven is like, it's just blessing upon blessing. It's God's goodness. And the Old Testament gave you that picture in the sense of plenty of food, protection, security. And so there's a material sense of blessing in the Old Testament as it pointed to what will be. But now Jesus says it's different. Blessing is seen and experienced differently. See, as we wait for what we will, for what will be, those who are blessed now, Jesus says it's not seen in riches or abundant materialism or food and security and safety. It's the opposite. It's not that those other things in the picture seen in the Old Testament won't come. It's just not yet. And throughout these verses, Luke makes that clear by adding the word now. You see it twice in verse 22. And then in verse 23, as he talks about rejoicing, he talks rejoice in that day, and that day is the day when you're persecuted. It's now. But at the same time, Luke keeps talking about a promise of what will be, what is to come. Expectations are changing. See, what will blessing now look like? Not riches, not materialism, not universal praise and popularity. It's the opposite to what it seemed in the Old Testament. It's the opposite to what the world thinks. The blessed now, Jesus says, are the poor, the hungry, the sad, the persecuted. Those who experience God's favor now are these. Those who do not experience his favor are in contrast, and it's easy to see the parallels, verse 24 to 26, the rich, the well-fed, the happy, the loved by all. It's upside down. And it's worth just noting as we look at those who are blessed how these descriptions and these virtues tie together. The overwhelming picture is that of being poor. You see how that is tied to being in the kingdom of God now. There's no future promise tied to it. Blessed are the poor, yours is the kingdom of God now. And those who are poor are often hungry and they're often sad. And it seems that the reason why they are poor and hungry and sad is because they're persecuted. Because they're identified as being with Jesus. And just keeping that in mind, it's not all that needs to be said, but keeping that in mind helps us just to make sense of what Jesus is teaching here. So what does it mean then for us to be poor, hungry, and sad? Are we meant to read these things as purely spiritual? So blessed are the spiritually poor and the spiritually hungry and the spiritually sad who weep. Or are we to read it as kind of physically, literally as it were? Those who are literally poor and literally hungry and literally sad are blessed. And Jesus doesn't make it explicit here. in the same way he does in Matthew's gospel. There he adds, blessed are the poor in spirit. Here he doesn't. And the reason is because you're not meant to exclude either. Yes, primarily, largely, it will be spiritual in nature. And we'll know that because, as we'll see, that's how Luke largely interprets the poor and the hungry elsewhere in his gospel. But there is a sense that what is spiritually true is worked out, seen physically, literally, if I can put it that way. And that is seen particularly because of the contrast of what it is not to be blessed. See in the verses 24 onwards, the rich, the well-fed, the happy, the loved by all, it's speaking much more of literally than spiritually. And so because of that contrast, you don't want to dismiss, as it were, the literal. It's both and. So blessed then are the poor. And the poor who are blessed are not all the poor of the world, but those who recognize their spiritual need, their spiritual poverty, their need for Jesus. So you turn back to Luke chapter 4, verse 18. And as Jesus began his ministry there in the synagogue, he did so by quoting Isaiah 61. And we saw that at the time he declares that he's come to proclaim, verse 18, good news to the poor. And the poor in the context of Isaiah 61 are both literally poor, but they're also spiritually poor. And they're literally poor because they are under God's judgment, in exile, in Babylon. They're literally poor because of their spiritual poverty, as it were, because they were rejecting God in that sense. They were under his judgment. They were spiritually needy. And so the poor in Luke 6 who are blessed are those who see their deep need for Jesus. It's those who see they are under God's judgment. Under God's judgment for their rebellion against their Maker. And that what they need is Jesus. They need Jesus, as we'll see as we go through Luke, to die on a cross, to bear the punishment for our sin, to take the wrath of God for our rejection of our Maker. And that as he bears that, as he takes that judgment, those who see their need of Jesus to do that are saved. They become part of the kingdom of God. Theirs is the kingdom of God. 6 verse 20. They're the ones who are blessed. It's those who see that deep need of Jesus. They become part of his people and his kingdom. They gain heaven. And note, they gain it now in the sense. There's no promise attached. They gain it now. Now, we're not there yet, but such is coming to Jesus that actually I can be spoken of as being in his kingdom, being part of him now, even if I'm not, as it were, literally in heaven. It's those who are spiritually poor who see their deep need of Jesus, see that they're under his judgment. And although it's the spiritually poor who see their need, often it's the literal poor who are quicker to see their spiritual need. You begin to see how these things overlap. See, that the literal poor are not blinded by riches. They're not blinded by the wealth of the aged. They're not fooled into thinking all is okay. They see the need. And of course, it's not that the rich cannot enter the kingdom, but as Jesus will warn in Luke 18:25, it's harder for the rich. Because it's hard for them to see and feel their need, because to them, life just feels okay. It doesn't feel like I'm under the judgment of God. It doesn't feel like there ever could be the judgment of God. I mean, think of Roman Abramovich, you know, the Chelsea owner. You know, as he sits in his executive box watching Chelsea, or as he floats on his yacht, or as he sleeps in the penthouse suite hotels around the world, as he has every whim he ever desires met. He doesn't sit there and thinking, man, I must be a bad person. He thinks, life's good. It's okay. I'm feeling blessed in that sense. It's harder for the rich because they don't see their need. Don't see the need that actually there's a judgment to come. They feel okay. So it's easier in that sense for the poor to see it. But the other way it overlaps is being poor might just become a reality for those who follow Jesus. See, for to follow Jesus is to be willing to give it all up. It's to be generous with what he has given us. It's to lay down our lives and our wealth if he calls us to. It's to so throw in my lot with him. And in that sense, I become poor. I hold on loosely to all I have. For all I have is to be his. And he may in his grace give me much, and he may in his grace not. And the persecution that comes as those who are his might mean all I have is taken. As many a Christian saint in other parts of the world have experienced. Literally for declaring Christ, they're left with just the clothes on their back. They're poor. Literally. And Jesus says, this is what it means to follow me. It's not easy. You may be poor, literally. But you're blessed. Because you know you're Christ's. And you know the kingdom of God is yours. And you begin to see the upside down expectations of following Jesus. You have to be humbled. You have to see your spiritual need rather than thinking proudly, I'm good enough, I'm okay, I can do it on my own. And instead of riches now, it might mean poverty, literally. It's very different to the Old Testament. It's very different to what the world teaches. It's why actually prosperity gospel teaching is just so wicked and evil. Because nowhere does Jesus say we should expect a rich and comfortable life now. Rather, we should expect the opposite, especially in light of the persecution that might come. Do you see the cost? Blessed are the poor. But the kingdom of God is ours. We gain so much more than we'll ever lose. There's a blessing in being Jesus's. And then Jesus goes on, he said, blessed are the hungry now. And again, those who are spiritually poor, see their need, will be spiritually hungry. They want to be fed spiritually. But those who are physically poor will be physically hungry now. And of course, there is a sense, I think, that actually we'll never be spiritually satisfied now. Because we'll never gain all the spiritual benefits that are ours now. You only have to read Ephesians 1 and think of all the blessings. We're told every blessing in heaven and earth is ours, but I don't experience it all now. There's much to come that is in heaven. I experience some of it now, but not all of it. And so in that sense, there should be a spiritual kind of dissatisfaction. I should hunger for what is still to come. I should long for what is to come. And there should be a hunger and a longing of dissatisfaction with ourselves spiritually now, that I'm not as kind or as loving or as patient or as Christ-like as I could be. That there should be that sense of just spiritual dissatisfaction, a hunger to be more like Jesus, a hunger to what is to come. So there's a spiritual hunger that Jesus said, you'll be blessed for. But it might, of course, as well be that there are circumstances, because of persecution particularly, where I might become literally hungry, where I'll literally go without food. And there might be times as well as believers when we'll just go without, that we won't have all that we want, that we'll look at our neighbours and our friends and our families and there'll be a slight sense of... But actually, we begin to know we don't have it all now. We're not to be physically satisfied. There is discomfort in following Jesus. But there's blessing in it. Because we know we're Christ's. And because we see the promise that there will be a day when we will be satisfied both spiritually and physically. There will be a time in heaven where one will lack nothing in any sense of the word. But don't expect it now. Now there is hunger. Now there is dissatisfaction. And those who feel that and experience that, says Jesus, are blessed. And then Jesus says, blessed are those who weep, who are sad, at the spiritual state of affairs, and the reality that this world is in rebellion against the Lord, against his people, seen in the rejection and the persecution. And that may be felt by us, that leads us to weep as we're rejected or scorned or mocked. And of course, there should be a sadness within us as we look at the brokenness of our world, as we see the effects of sin, as we see the many who are lost, as we see those who have been created in the image of God in such dire need and circumstances. William Wilberforce, having been converted, was moved by seeing men and women and children in slavery, such that often as he spoke in Parliament, he ended up weeping. He would sit down and weep, so moved by the plight and the need of those in this world, because of the fallenness in one sense of it. We should be marked as those who are sad, who are affected by the state of the world, who weep, saddened by its brokenness, saddened by its rejection of Christ, sometimes experienced in persecution that makes me literally weep. Seeing the world as Christ sees it, experiencing it as Christ did, rejection. But Jesus says there will be a time when we will laugh. There will be a time when we'll be filled with joy, when we see a new creation, when we see Jesus, when we see the wrongs of this world righted and sin and death and rebellion removed. But don't expect it now. Now there's weeping and sadness. And those who feel it, those who experience that, are blessed. And then Jesus says, blessed are those are you when people hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man, because of me. And you see how it starts with hatred but then gets worse? And Jesus says, look, those who follow me, those who are mine, you'll be treated this way. Spiritually, Satan will oppose you. Physically, earthly, man will oppose you. You will be hated. You will be excluded. You will be insulted. You will be rejected. Social ostracizing will be par of the course. You won't be invited to that work social. You won't be invited to that mum's meal out because, hey, you cramp their style. You don't quite drink as much as they do. You don't join in the gossip as they do. They don't want you there. You might just happen to speak about Jesus. And they don't want you ruining their evening. You'll be rejected because the moral compass, our moral compass is so different now to the world. You'll speak to friends who will speak favorably about Jesus, but then you'll get onto the issue of same-sex marriages. And they'll shun you. They'll just say, I just cannot agree with you on that. And your friendship will begin to be different. A loss. A rejection. And we shouldn't be surprised when that's the case. We shouldn't be surprised that we're hated when we speak of Jesus. We shouldn't be surprised that we're hated when we speak of sin or eternal things, because people hate Jesus and they hate us as those who are his people. But note what Jesus says. Verse 23. Rejoice in such a day. It's not even talking about rejoicing in heaven looking back. It's rejoice in that day when you're persecuted. And not just rejoice, leap for joy. Exuberant happiness. Why? Well, because one, you will receive a reward in heaven. And it'd be worth it. The reward will not be some lame Kinder Egg surprise. I think those things are the biggest disappointment ever. The chocolate is great. You get in there. There's that little yellow plastic thing. And you think, great little toy. No kid ever keeps those toys. They get put in the recycling bin. a waste. Jesus says, it's not going to be like that. You get to heaven, it's going to be a great reward, a glorious reward. It's unlimited blessings. You're at the harvester fountain again. Shh. None of you guys are ever going to be able to go to the harvester again without thinking blessing in heaven as you go to that fountain. It's unlimited. There's this reward. He says, secondly, though, you're to rejoice and leap for joy, because if you're being persecuted, it means you're proclaiming the truth. And you're just like the prophets of old, who were from God and were persecuted. Persecution is a mark not of doing something wrong, but doing something right. In the Old Testament, if your enemies opposed you, it was a mark you were outside of God's favor. Now it's a mark of his favor. I think of the apostles in Acts 5. You know, they're dragged before the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin says to them, look, you must stop talking about Jesus. No, we can only do what God has commanded us to do. Pharisee, he says, you know, well, if it's of God, we'll just leave him to do it. But they can't just leave it. They have to beat them. And they flog the disciples. And what do the disciples do? You just got to love that next line. They leave rejoicing, leaping for joy. Why? Because they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name for Jesus. Just like the prophets of old. We're to rejoice at persecution. We'll receive the reward. There'll be a day when we're safe, but it's not now. Now it's persecution and rejection. And those who experience it and feel it, Jesus says, are blessed. Do you see, in Jesus' kingdom, to be blessed, to experience the favor of God, it's all upside down to what you might expect. It's the poor, it's the hungry, it's the sad, it's the rejected, the persecuted who are blessed. Because that's what it looks like to live for Jesus. It's to be poor, both spiritually and maybe at times actually. It's to be hungry spiritually and at times physically. It's to be sad spiritually and at times literally to weep. It's to be rejected and hated and ostracized. Jesus says these are the ones who are blessed. And in the world's ears, that doesn't sound like blessing. But it is, both in the now, because now I know I'm Jesus and I identified as his and in his kingdom. And in what will be satisfaction, laughter, reward that lasts not for a mere 80 or so years, but for all eternity. And where would you rather be? Experiencing Jesus' favor, experiencing the blessing that is to come and knowing that you are part of him and with him, or outside of it. And look what Jesus says about that. You'll be glad to know that this is much shorter. Woe to those who reject Christ. Woe to those. And that word woe here is the opposite of being in God's favor. It's an exclamation of pain and pity for someone's misfortune. And the woe comes over their rejection of Christ. It's seen by the fact that these are the opposite descriptions to those who are Christ, with the inferences that you've rejected the Son of Man. And then verse 26 brings it home. They've listened to the false prophets. They've rejected the truth that comes from God. Now, there's a much more literal sense of being rich. Jesus, I think, is overturning that thinking that says, hey, somehow the rich are those who are blessed by God. There is some sense where the Old Testament kind of thought that and the world thinks that. And it may be that rich person is blessed, but it's no indicator. And nor when Jesus talks about rich, is he thinking of the kind of billionaires. You know, the top 10 of the UK's richest people that came out this weekend. One guy sadly moved down a place. He lost 50 million this year. He's still got billions, so don't worry. But Jesus isn't talking about the top 10 rich. He's talking about the rich in the sense of you have what you desire and you have what you want now and you don't go without much. Look what he says. Jesus says that you have comfort. He says you're well fed. He says you laugh, you enjoy life in spite of the world and around its needs. People speak well of you. You're accepted and liked and popular. You're at every party and gathering. You live as you wish to live, according to what you want, with no reference to God. And Jesus says your reward is now. It's all now. And all these things are called, all these things indicate the rejection of Christ. To live this way is the complete opposite to who Christ says are in his kingdom. And as such, the future holds for these ones judgment. You had your reward, as it were. Your future will mean your comfort is removed. You will be hungry. You will mourn and weep. And Jesus is talking, isn't he, of anything but heaven. It's the opposite of where the believer goes. It's hell. It's the removal of good. It's the opposite of the believer's experience. The believer's experience is suffering, then enjoyment. Jesus says the rich is enjoyment, then suffering. Seeming fun life now, but you fail to see what is to come. And Jesus gives this graphic picture of this in Luke 16, where we read of the rich man and Lazarus. And the rich man, we're told, 16 verse 19, is dressed in purple and he wears fine linen. And he lives in luxury every day. He's comfortable. He's well fed. He laughs. He's well liked. He begins every day with freshly ground coffee and an almond croissant served on a silver platter. And at his door is Lazarus, the beggar, covered with sores, poor, longing to eat, hungry, presumably sad and in pain, and no one likes him, only the dogs lick him. Lazarus dies and he's in heaven. The rich man dies and he's in Hades. He's in torment. And the rich man begs, reversal of fortunes. And he begs to Father Abraham, please have pity. Give me a drop of water. I'm in agony. And Abraham replies, son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted. And you are in agony. And the choice is apparent. What do you want? Seeming reward now, but suffering later, or suffering now and reward for eternity? And Jesus, obviously in Luke 16, and here on one level, is warning the crowd, particularly the Pharisees who are listening, who are clearly beginning to hate Jesus, chapter 6, verse 11. They're plotting to kill him. And his warning to them is this. Yes, you might enjoy life now. Yes, you might be comfortable, well-fed, laugh, well-liked, have much prestige. You might walk around and everyone respect you. And you think because of this, you're blessed, that somehow you have God's favor. But friends, it's all change. It's all about me. It's all about how you relate to me and what you think is blessing is not. It's actually woe. And of course, when you hear that bluntly, wouldn't you much rather be blessed as those who are poor, hungry, sad, unliked, and received eternal blessing than have it all now? And yet, how often we choose the now? How often I choose to love comfort and riches and life now? Because I forget what is to come. And if you are not following Christ this morning, hear the warning. Life may now seem good, but from the perspective of eternity, it is not. Friend, it is like playing with mud balls when you can have diamonds. What are you going to choose? But Jesus, as well, on another level, is warning his disciples. Us. He's saying, don't be like that. Don't get sucked into the worldly comforts and the riches and the now. And the sting for us, as those who live in rich, well-fed, easy days, who are well-liked, is we need to examine our hearts. We need to examine our hearts and say, look, am I just going through a season of life The Lord is allowing this season, this period for a reason, in which life at this moment, I'm not experiencing much rejection. There doesn't seem to be particularly a pinch on things. I'm doing all that the Lord has commanded. I'm seeking to be generous. I'm seeking to evangelize. But right now, there just doesn't seem that person. And it may just be that the Lord has put us in a season where that is true. And at that point, we thank God and rejoice. But we need to examine our hearts, because it may just be as well that I'm becoming more like the rich than I care to say. That actually I'm not living for Christ, I'm being sucked into the world. Because Jesus makes it clear there's a cost to following him. And if I've never felt that cost, if I've never had that sense of spiritual need or spiritual hunger or dissatisfaction or sadness at the state of the world or the loss, or I've never been rejected or shunned or left out or mocked or had a word spoken against me because I am Jesus's, if I've never in my giving felt the pinch of having to make a choice to give things up, to give to others, if I've never felt the sense of life is hard because I am Christ, that I'm not having what the world wants and desires and enjoys, if you've never felt that cost, if you've never experienced that cost, then maybe, maybe you're more like the rich than the poor. And you need to hear the warning. You need to seek Jesus. And you need to ask him, Lord, show me. Show me where I can be more generous in my giving. Show me where you want me to speak. Is it that person who I sit next to in the workplace each day? Is it my neighbor down the road? Lord, you want me to speak to them, even though I know it might be costly. Lord, what is it you want me to give up? Where is it that there is a cost to following you in my life? Help me to see it. Because friend, if there is no cost in following Jesus, it may be it's a season, and we thank God. It may be revealing that you're more like the rich than you are the poor. And friends, to not live for Jesus is to miss out. It's to miss out on the blessing of being his. It's to miss out on the blessing of what is to come. It's living, as C.S. Lewis wrote, is playing with mud pies when the beach and the sea are just there. Don't miss out. Blessed are those who are Christ. Woe to those who are not Christ's.